Welcome to the Miller Center and to those who are watching on our webcast at some remote location. Welcome to you too. Somebody coming in a little while ago said, my goodness, with all the cars and people out here, it looks like free sample day at a gold mine. I think with David Broder, we do have a gold mine in terms of political expertise. A couple of announcements. As you know, we're celebrating the Festival of the Book. This event today is, since David Broder is the author of seven books, is part of the Festival of the Book celebration. And tomorrow morning, we have another event here. We have Anne Beattie, who is one of the foremost fiction writers. Almost every month, one of her short stories is published in New Yorker, and she's published a number of collections. And her husband, Lincoln Perry, is America's foremost muralist. He did the big murals in Old Cabell Hall. And they're going to do a very interesting presentation about how the effect of how his work, his way of looking at things, his artistic eye influences her fiction writing and vice versa. And unfortunately, we advertised the event for 11 o'clock. The Festival of the Book publicity advertised the event for 10 o'clock. Ours wins. The correct time will be 11 o'clock, although if people arrive early, we have coffee downstairs, and we'll try to make everybody welcome. I hope everybody has received the announcement. If you're not on our mailing list, please let us know so we can make sure you get on our mailing list. And the little survey form that was on your seat when you came in, even if you filled it out before, please fill it out this time because we're collecting information that will help us plan better for the future of the forum program. David Broder, as I'm certain everyone here knows, is the national political correspondent for the Washington Post. He started his career with bachelor's and master's degrees in political science at the University of Chicago. He joined the New York Times, covered politics for the Washington Star, wrote for the Congressional Quarterly, and joined the Post in 1966. He is regularly seen and heard giving thoughtful commentary on CNN's Inside Politics, on Meet the Press, and on Washington Week in Review. He's written seven books, either written or co-authored seven books. Most recently, Democracy Derailed, Initiative Campaigns and the Power of Money. He has won every major award for political coverage and journalism, including namesake of this facility, the White Burkitt Miller Presidential Award. He had received the 1973 Pulitzer Prize for Distinguished Commentary. One critic of Washington pundits said, Broder is not famous like Peter Jennings, he's not glamorous like Tom Brokaw, but underneath that brown suit, there's a Superman. So please join me in welcoming a super correspondent, David Broder.
Thank you very much for that introduction. It is a great pleasure for Ann and me to be back here at the Miller Center. We've had the opportunity and the pleasure of being visitors here many times before. I would be remiss if I did not, at the very beginning, say a special word of greeting to my old friend Ken Thompson, who can't be with us today, but who I trust will, in one way or another, get word of the greeting. He has been a wonderful friend over the years, and I cherish his friendship and his wisdom. I have to say I am a little intimidated by the size of the turnout this afternoon. For some reason, it puts me in mind of an evening not that long ago when my late publisher, Catherine Graham, had a gathering at her home in Georgetown for Art Buchwald, who had just published, I think, the second volume of his memoirs. And as you can well imagine, when Mrs. Graham issued an invitation for a party, it was about as close to being a summons as anything in Washington. So the group that had assembled in the back porch in the lawn of her home on our street included, you know, much of the White House staff and cabinet, and a very good representation from both parties on Capitol Hill, and of course much of the press corps. At any rate, after a few people had roasted Buchwald and it was finally his turn to get to the microphone, I can't do that Brooklyn accent of his, but Art stood there and looked over this not too shabby assemblage, and his remark was, "You know, Dick Morris is right. There ain't anything to do in Washington on a Tuesday night." I can't imagine what put me in mind of of that, but I'm very grateful that you all are here. And I look forward to the part of our hour together that will be yours, when we can actually have a conversation back and forth. I was asked to talk a little bit about what's happening in Washington now and project a little bit perhaps as to what's to come. I start, of course, with the central player, the President of the United States, who, as always, whoever is sitting in that Oval Office is the dominant force in Washington at any given moment. I have to tell you that I did not know this George Bush at all well before he came into the political scene. When his father, who I did know much better, was vice president and then president, another reporter on the Post staff, a wonderful woman named Ann Devroy, who died much too young from cancer. Devroy had George W. Bush as a great source. And the rest of us on the national reporting staff tried to cultivate other people who were around in those administrations, because we assumed, and I think correctly, that anything that we would learn from George W., Devroy would learn, because they really did have a good, trusting relationship. So I had never actually sat down with or met the younger George Bush until the year that he was planning to run for governor of Texas for the first time. And I went down to Dallas because I wanted to meet this man, and sat in the little office that he was using in an office park on the edge of Dallas. And we did an interview. And the one thing that I remember about the interview was that at some point during the conversation, Bush is on his side of the metal desk, and I'm sitting across from him. He kind of leaned forward and said, in a very flat tone, "I'm going to be governor of Texas." Now, this was anything but an obvious statement at the time, because he was running against Governor Ann Richards, who was a popular and well-established figure. But what I remember about the moment was that the subtext of what he was saying was, "I believe this, and frankly, it doesn't matter a damn to me whether you believe it or not, because I believe it." Skip forward now 6 years to 2000. When he is running for president the first time. And as you may remember, in that first campaign, he opened the campaign with a proposal for an across-the-board tax cut. I think originally maybe it was supposed to be 30% across the board. But it made perfect sense politically, because the assumption in the Bush campaign, and it wasn't much different in the press corps, was that the only serious rival, perhaps, for the nomination on the Republican side was going to be Steve Forbes. Steve Forbes was wealthy personally, could match him with money. Steve Forbes had run for the nomination once before. Steve Forbes was well identified as being an advocate of tax reform, a flat tax proposal. So it made perfect sense that George Bush would want to have his own tax cut plan entering the campaign. So they go to New Hampshire, and lo and behold, turns out the real opponent is not Steve Forbes, but John McCain, who goes to New Hampshire, the most tax-averse, perhaps, of all the 50 states, and campaigns as somebody who is saying, I'm going to be very honest with you, I don't think we can afford a big tax cut at this point. And he beats Bush in New Hampshire by 19 percentage points. Then they go on to South Carolina, and it's a different set of issues in South Carolina. Bush reverses the result on McCain, and the campaign goes on. And I remember being on the plane one day, right after South Carolina, and having this conversation with Karl Rove, because as soon as we left South Carolina, Bush started talking about tax cuts again. By this time, the Post and almost all the other news organizations had done our own polls about this issue. And what we were finding was that there was no great popular demand, even among Republicans, for major tax cuts at that point. The states were rolling in money. Most states had cut their own taxes, and it was not just a big issue. So I had this conversation on the plane with Karl Rove, and I said, help me understand something. Why has he gone back to talking about tax cuts? What are we missing in our polls that you guys are finding in yours? And he said, our polls are exactly the same as yours. And I said, well, then why is he doing it? Answer, he believes it. He believes it. And that was my second clue. This is somebody who has enormous confidence in himself and almost in his own destiny, if you will, also has enormous confidence in his own set of ideas. I don't want to be clever, but in a real sense, this is a faith-based presidency. This is somebody who has enormous faith in his own ability and destiny, enormous faith in his own set of ideas. Now, there are important advisors, obviously, in this presidency. Dick Cheney is an important influence. In the areas of defense, military, Don Rumsfeld is an important influence. Condoleezza Rice is an important influence. There may be one or two others, Andy Card. But the notion that I think at least some in the press have tried to create, which is that Bush is the sort of the front man for this administration, but the real thinking and the real sort of energy and the real ideology is coming from other people, I think is probably 180 degrees mistaken. The key person in this administration, in this White House, is the president himself. He is the driving force in the Bush administration. And the other thing that we now know and can say, I think, fairly definitively about him is that he is, in the classic sense, a real risk taker. He is a gambler. This is, again, in my part, a total misjudgment of the man that I thought I was covering in the first campaign. I thought that it was not an accident that George W. Bush, who had been kind of aimless in terms of his life direction for much of his life, the year after his father defeated for the presidency, decides, I'm going to run, go into politics and run at a high level for the governor of Texas. And I thought what this was really all about was somebody who was trying to sort of restore the family's good name and if you will, restore the family franchise at the White House, but didn't have any terribly big, bold ambitions beyond that, which was bold enough. That was 180 degrees wrong on my part. He has turned out to be, even if the presidency ended today, it would go into the history books as a very consequential presidency because of the large-scale policy changes that he has engineered, even though his first election was shadowed, to put it politely, by the circumstances in which he came to the presidency, and even this second election, where he finally won an actual majority of the popular vote, was not, in any sense, an overwhelming, massive majority there. But he has governed as if he had a huge head of steam behind him. Just think about the fundamental postures and institutions that have changed because George Bush has been the president. In terms of fiscal policy, we have gone from a time of large and growing surpluses to a time of large and growing deficits. In tax policy, the level of taxation, 17% now overall, one of the lowest in our modern history. The distribution of taxes, who pays and who doesn't pay, has shifted radically. If you think about basic institutions in this country, education, for the first time, we have the federal government in Washington, D.C., monitoring and grading the performance of every child and every school in this country with real consequences for the grades that they are given by Washington. Healthcare policy, the largest single addition to the federal health repertoire since the creation of Medicare, the addition of prescription drug benefits to Medicare. Regulatory policy, environmental policy, almost any area of domestic policy you want to mention. This president has fundamentally changed policy direction. Say nothing about overseas, where he has rewritten the book on our relationships with Europe, old Europe or new Europe, where he abandoned explicitly what had been for 45 years the major doctrine of American foreign policy, the containment policy, and substituted a new policy called preemption of threat, and applied that policy controversially by himself in the case of Iraq. It is a huge change that has taken place in this presidency, and he has been willing on all of these fronts to challenge the status quo. He is also politically now attempting to break what has been, in effect, a stalemate in American politics, the almost perfect mathematical balance between Republican and Democratic Party, between red states and blue states, and trying to change it in a direction that would make the Republican Party clearly the majority party in this country. The major policy gamble that is part of that process is, of course, the effort to change what may be the most deeply embedded of all the domestic programs of government, Social Security, which he has now said needs to be fundamentally changed to survive into the 21st century. At this point, the gamble that he's taking on Social Security does not appear to be a winning bet. He has tried now to frame it in generational terms, telling people who are 55 and older that they will not be affected by this, but their skepticism is deep-seated and has so far not yielded to his arguments. And he's telling the younger people that they will have opportunities to control their own retirement future through private investments, but the young people are, as always, very difficult to mobilize politically as a viable force. And at this moment, he appears not to be winning that argument, and indeed, if you talk to the Democrats, they would tell you that he has opened himself, perhaps, to a successful counterattack by a party that has not found very many openings so far during the Bush presidency. The Democrats are not in good shape at this point. Psychologically, they felt whipped by what has happened to them in the midterm election of 2002, and then the severe disappointment that they felt in 2004 when they thought, and perhaps actually had, achieved their biggest mobilization effort, best mobilization effort in their modern history. They increased their vote, particularly in battleground states, as much or more than they hoped to do, and still found themselves outvoted in states like Ohio, which turned out to be the crucial states in this period. Now, what happens from this point on, we don't know. At this stage, the president is fighting a defensive battle and perhaps an uphill battle on his major domestic initiatives. The budget situation offers him nothing but pain. There is no good news to be found anywhere for him or anyone else in this current budget situation. All there is pain, and how are we going to allocate the pain? The short-term savings that he has asked for, which the Congress is debating preliminarily now in the budget resolution, are painful enough. But what makes it much harder is that even if all of those short-term economies were made, the large issue would still remain. How are we going to finance the retirement and health care benefits for this huge baby boom generation, which is now just 4 or 5 years away from beginning to reach the point where they become claimants of these entitlement programs? No one in either party is prepared to answer that question definitively, and we go into it, of course, with very large deficits. My guess is that unless the president is able to find some way in the coming months to turn the Social Security debate, and a number of Republicans are now looking and offering alternatives to his original proposal on Social Security, so the door is not closed to some form of compromise, but unless he finds some way to move gracefully beyond that, my guess is that by the end of this year, he will look back and say, well, I gave it my best shot, and it's just not doable today, and turn back to what would have to be, from the White House perspective, more promising areas of achievement on the international scene. The news out of the Middle East is much better than almost any of us expected it to be at this point. The change in leadership on the Palestinian side does seem to have brought a reciprocal reaction from the Israelis, and there are at least, knock on wood, some hopeful signs that they are beginning to back away from the intransigence on both sides of that issue. In Lebanon, we are seeing what looks to be a popular movement to try to remove or reduce the Syrian influence, which also can only be a positive step. We're getting some signals even from Mubarak that the idea of moving towards some form of democracy in Egypt may be taking root there, all of which is very promising to the president and clearly something in which he has a genuine passion. I heard him speak informally at the Gridiron Dinner on Saturday night, and after he'd done the jokes, which he did very well, he spoke for just maybe 2 minutes about his own sense of the changing dynamic in the Middle East. But he spoke very movingly, and it's clear that this is a cause that is truly on his heart and one where he believes that there is now some daylight that is possible. So my guess is that he will once again become primarily a foreign policy-focused president, which is fine in itself, but it also, I'm afraid, means that it will be left to his successor and those in government starting 3.5, 4 years from now to wrestle with the whole after effects of huge budget deficits, Social Security and Medicare systems, which are unaffordable, and the whole question of how we're going to finance the remaining years for that very large baby boom generation. On that happy note, let me wind up, and I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you.
Who would like to start the conversation? Jim Holden?
I wonder if you would.
Would you, Jim, can I ask you to wait until the microphone?
Thank you. I wonder if you might comment on the judicial nomination battle and how you see that unfolding.
They are adamant on both sides of that. I mean, it is stunning to me, even in conversation which I approach as a journalist, not an advocate on one side or the other, but the degree of passion with which both the Democrats in the Senate and many of those close to the president at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue speak about that issue, there's just not much give there. There is a sense of grievance, of almost personal grievance, on both sides. And I don't know what, if anything, can be done at this point to avoid just a real collision and showdown on these judicial nominations. Institutionally, I said to somebody the other day, in a fantasy world, I can imagine these new buddies, former presidents Bush and Clinton, writing a joint letter to the leadership of the Congress and the President of the United States saying, think about what you are doing to an independent branch of the government of the United States and ask yourselves if there is not some responsibility that you all have to protect the independence and the functioning of the judicial branch of the government. I have a friend, now senior district court judge in Louisiana, who is on the phone to me, I would say, every other week, saying, do these damn fools know what they are doing to us with this politicization of the judiciary? But I have to say, talking to both the White House end and the Senate end of Pennsylvania Avenue, I do not find any sense of larger responsibility that on either side that is going to call them to account and force them to think about whether they have some other responsibility.
David Brunneman?
Yes, can I ask a follow-up question to that? I mean, as far as I can tell from reading about it, this so-called nuclear option of going to the simple majority is doable. I mean, could be done. I mean, that couldn't be blocked. And then the Democratic response to that is to say they'll sort of stop all business in the Senate in ways I'm not fully sure I understand, but I wonder if you could play out that scenario, because that strikes me as a perfectly plausible thing that might happen down the road, given what you just said earlier.
Well, it's a high risk on both sides. At this point, I am told, although I'm not sure that anybody has actually done a head count, but I am told that it is not at all certain that the Republicans could hold enough of their own people to apply the nuclear option. Nuclear option meaning a ruling from the chair, presumably Vice President Cheney, that a simple majority, 51 votes, would be sufficient to cut off debate on a judicial nomination. That is an option that Senator Frist and others have said they are considering, and the Democrats have said, if you do this, we will shut down the Senate. I am told that at this point, Frist is not at all certain that he has 51 Republican votes to do that. If he did, I think the risks are at least as great for the Democrats. I mean, I think back to what happened when Mr. Gingrich and the House Republicans thought that they had President Clinton over a barrel and threatened to shut down the government for a few days, which they did. But they forgot that the megaphone that people hear belongs to the president, and that Congress is not in a good position to compete effectively when the battle for public opinion with any president. And for the Democrats to talk about permanently closing down the operations of the United States Senate seems to me to be at least as large a risk, maybe larger, than what it is entailed for the Republicans enforcing them to that kind of a 51-vote cloture.
Dr. Turner?
You had mentioned mentors of President Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld. You talked about Karl Rove a little bit earlier, and I wondered if there was an oversight not listing Karl Rove in your list again. And the second part of the question is, what is the relationship between George Bush and his father, George W. Bush, in terms of mentoring, advising, and on-the-job types of things, other than just being a warm and friendly dad?
I certainly should have included Karl Rove in the list of those who is influential with the president. We're not certain because of the large blanket of secrecy that surrounds presidential decision-making in this administration, exactly what issues Karl weighs in on and how much influence he has on those issues. But there's no question that he is in the room and that he is part of that decision-making, so I should have put his name back into that context as well. The impression that both generations of Bushes wish to give is that the father does not offer much advice to the son. I don't think we will know until the memoirs are written years from now as to what may be happening behind the scenes. But it is fairly clear, for example, that in areas of foreign policy, those who are closest to George H.W. Bush, including General Scowcroft and Jim Baker, have had a lot of differences with the foreign policy of George W. Bush. So in the area where you would think that the father's influence might be most telling, it does not appear that those in the father's circle are terribly comfortable with the decision-making that the son has made.
Question from one of the outer rooms. Would you care to comment on the appointment of Josh Bolton to be ambassador to the United Nations?
John Bolton.
John Bolton.
Yeah. There are two interpretations, and I can't tell you which is correct. One is that this is Bush tipping his hat and giving a great sort of boon to the hardcore conservative part of his constituency. The other interpretation is that this is a brilliant move on the part of the president and Condoleezza Rice to move out of Washington and out of the decision-making hierarchy, somebody who may not be comfortable with the direction in which they are now taking foreign policy. I don't think we know the answer yet. I mean, people on the inside may very well know what was the real motivation. I don't think we know on the outside what the real motivation was yet, and I think we'll have to see sort of how Bolton plays his hand at the United Nations and what, if any, influence he retains in the decision-making in Washington.
Comment, please, Mr. Broder, on the recent appointment of Wolfowitz to the International Monetary Fund.
The only conversations that I've had about this in the office yesterday, I was surprised at some of the people who have been very critical of Wolfowitz in his role on Iraq policy, who think that he may be a very good choice for this job. It's somewhat Nick the Nixon goes to China theory, but it's also that people who know him a good deal better than I do, and I know him only from casual conversations at the home of our next door neighbor, Ken Edelman, where Wolfowitz is a frequent guest, and we are occasional guests, is that he has a genuine personal, intellectual, and political interest in that part of the world where development assistance is very important. So personally, I'm prepared to say, you know, let's see what he does. There were lots of good reasons, I think, to find fault with his role in Iraq, including, obviously, from a journalist's point of view, what you could call gently the misunderstanding or misstatement of conditions in Iraq that caused the war there. So I'm not, I think all of that has to be dealt with in itself, but I'm not certain that this is a disqualification for doing this job.
Yes, ma'am. That was your
question. Here's a broad question, perhaps too broad, but you mentioned that we have a faith-based presidency, and what's the source of this firmness and confidence? Does it spring from religion, philosophy, ideology, personal experience? you could play psychologist if you wish.
Well, I think reporters make damn poor psychiatrists, so I'm a little reluctant to tread on this, but let me say this. I think one of the... If you credit George Bush's own account of his own life at all, as reflecting in some ways the reality of what took place, this is somebody who basically in his 40s decided to grow up and did it apparently overnight. His story, as he tells it, is that he woke up hungover one morning in Colorado Springs and said, "That's it, I'm quitting," and quit. Any of us who have had any dealings with alcohol abusers in our lives, as most of us have, knows that that is damn hard to do. But whatever he turned to make that happen, I think gave him a sense about what he was capable of doing, and he clearly has this, the unattractive side of it is what people refer to as the smirk or the strut and so on. But there is this enormous sense of self-confidence that just he radiates. And whether it is from a religious experience or a personal experience, that's beyond my capacity to judge, but I think it's real. And it has both positive and negative sides. I mean, it makes it very hard, you know, gives him the boldness to go ahead and, without any kind of a popular mandate, make the kind of change, fundamental change in policy that he has made. On the other hand, it makes it very hard for him ever to second guess himself. And there are costs in that.
Another question that I'll read as it was submitted. Can you comment on the declining readership and respect for the mainstream press, the Post, the Times, in the light of the rising influence of talk radio, bloggers, and the internet?
Well, that's a topic, you know, that I won't talk as long as I did the first time around, but it is a large topic. Let me just say this. I am not one who mourns the rise of talk radio or of blogs. I think when you can have channel of dialogue in this country, it's a good thing, per se. The Washington Post gets something like 1,500 to 2,000 letters, emails a week from people who have made the effort to sit down and in one form or another tell us what their thoughts are, their reaction to what's happening in the world or what they've read in the newspaper. We publish about 150 of those in the newspaper, which means that every single week we are frustrating that many people who have made the effort to engage in a dialogue there. I think it's got to be a good thing that there are places that they can go now and vent their views, air their views. I wish, obviously, that there was a little bit more of what I regard as good journalism standards being practiced by blogs and by the hosts of on talk radio. I mean, my favorite amusement when I'm on the road, which I am a lot, is to turn on the car radio and find the local talk radio station. And you can sometimes damn near drive off the side of the road because of the amazing things that you hear being said on the public airways. And they say, where in the world did they get that idea? Nonetheless, I'm very glad that it's out there. What's happening on the print side, or so-called establishment journalism, is there are both positive and negative aspects to it. The positive side, which we don't talk about much, is that wherever you live in this country now, I see this as a political reporter traveling the country, you have available to you, in addition to whatever the local news media may provide, you've got three national daily newspapers, two of which are among the very best papers in the country, New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, the third, USA Today, rapidly becoming a serious, good newspaper. In addition to that, you have all of the resources of National Public Radio, to which I am personally addicted. You have the spectrum of what's available now on cable news, including all of the unmediated stuff on C-SPAN. Probably some of you were listening or watching the congressional hearing today. Nobody interfering. You just watch the actual event unfold on C-SPAN. You have infinite variety of magazines, commentary, and so on. And now, of course, you've got the internet, which is just an enormously rich resource. Result of that is that you now I can go into any community of any size, anywhere in the country, and there will be a cadre of local people who are every bit as well-informed, every bit as engaged in public affairs as the people in this room. They get it. They've made the effort, and they know exactly where to access all of that information and opinion that they want. There's also the downside, which is everything that everybody has written about, the subordination of network news operations into larger and larger corporations where they have fewer and fewer, less and less control over their own budgets, the loss of daily newspaper competition in so many places, and for papers like ours and most of the other so-called serious newspapers, a loss of print circulation. That is more than made up for by the number of people who are now reading us online, but it's not the same trade-off economically, because we get advertising dollars for our print version, and we are only beginning to recoup financially in advertising for the web version of the paper. And that's a real question. I don't know what the future. You can produce a newspaper pretty cheaply if you want to. If you want quality, it's expensive because it's labor intensive. And we'll just have to see sort of how much of a demand there is for that kind of quality journalism.
You stressed the faith that President Bush has in his own policies. Why is he therefore not prepared to have open debate on the issues, but screens the audience at every meeting?
Why indeed? Good question. I have to say, I think that that there is the penchant for secrecy and control in this administration, which is not unique. I mean, every president that I've ever covered has really wanted to, if he could, just control the whole damn environment in which he operates. But they have it to an exaggerated degree. It is worrisome. It is everything that the critics say, in my view, which is that it shows a lack of confidence, not so much in his leadership, but a lack of confidence in the basic process of debate and discussion, which has been the genius of the American system. I don't know what the answer to that is. I would speculate that, I mean, this is knowing his parents much better than I know him. I see much more of Barbara Bush in the makeup of this president than I see of George H.W. Bush. And Barbara Bush, as long as I've known her, and she has many wonderful qualities, but she does indeed tend to divide the world between those who are with us and those who are not. And there's a pretty sharp line of demarcation.
The memory of a water buffalo.
At this point, who do you think the viable candidates will be for the Democratic and Republican Democratic and Republican 2008 presidential nomination?
I don't know. When I'm not in Virginia, I immediately say, well, we've got a wonderful governor in Virginia, and they say, who's that? And then I try to tell them that about Mark Warner, but I have no idea. And I mean, anybody who can tell you now who's going to be running in 2008, they're a lot smarter than I am.
Dr. Weary?
Would you comment about the administration and the Congress's position and record on the environment, please?
The environment is an issue that I have to admit I know much less about than I should. My sense is that, as is usually the case with a Republican administration or Republican Congress, when you come to making the trade-offs between development and protection of the environment, the tilt in a Republican Congress and a Republican administration is toward development. And I think that's what we are seeing again this time. How consequential those things will be, I'm frankly not smart enough to know. That's not a very satisfactory answer, but that's the best I can do, I'm afraid.
Bob Gibson is the David Broder of the Charlottesville Daily Progress.
order a question, but I'll try anyway. It seems that from time to time the Senate talks a good game of hardball, but the House plays a good game of hardball. What's the relationship between President Bush and Tom DeLay, and what ramifications do you see in the future stemming from Tom DeLay's ethical self-confidence?
As far as we can tell, Bush is more comfortable dealing with Denny Hastert and was until he made the appointment today of picking Rob Portman for the trade representative, going through Rob Portman on the Ways and Means Committee as his liaison with the House, then relying directly on DeLay. But Bush has not caused any problems for DeLay. He understands that DeLay is the choice of the Republican conference for the majority leadership and seems to be perfectly comfortable letting the Republicans and the House pick their own leadership. He did not do what he did, you know, with Trent Lott, where there was a not very subtle White House hand in pushing Lott out the door and bringing Bill Frist in as his successor. That has not happened on the House side, at least if any of us have been able to catch them at any sort of internal politicking of that sort. So my guess is that as long as the House Republican Conference supports DeLay, the White House will be very happy to deal with DeLay.
Dr. Aldrich, here comes a microphone.
Would you comment on the appointment of Governor Dean to the Democratic National Committee job and what the implications are for the future of the Democratic Party?
Governor Dean won the job the old-fashioned way, which is that he went out to get it and worked very hard to get it. The Democratic National Committee is a strange sort of assemblage at this point. It's partly reflective of interest groups and constituencies in the party. It's partly reflective of the folks who had the wit to pick the winning candidate in their state's caucuses or primaries last year. But the main reason that Dean got the job was that he campaigned very hard for it. He said a number of things that the people on the committee wanted to hear. He said that he would use the same kind of technique for the National Committee that he used in his own campaign to build up the internet as a fundraising device. He said that he believed in local organization. He said that he came from a rural state, and surprisingly enough, that fact was mentioned by a lot of folks, including some of the Southern chairmen and National Committee members who ended up supporting him when you said, well, you know, why in the world would they be backing this liberal from Vermont? They liked the fact that he knew rural areas and knew rural issues there. So it was a classic different strokes for different folks kind of an appeal that he had. Since he's been in the job, which is, what, a month now, he has done almost no rabble-rousing and has done a lot of fundraising, which is exactly what they hoped that he would do. I think it's going to be constitutionally very difficult for Howard Dean keep his trap shut for 4 years. I don't think he's constituted that way. But for the moment, he is deferring all policy issues, saying, well, that's really up to the members of Congress or to the governors. That's not my job to set policy for the party. I don't believe that'll last forever. And as a journalist, of course, we hope it ends soon. But He's a much more interesting and subtle person than the caricature that emerged, particularly in the late stages of that race for the presidency. And I think, you know, there's a possibility that he may turn out to be useful. I think for the Democrats, I almost feel certain he'll be useful to us in the press at some point.
Mr. Middleditch?
Apparently, President Vincente Fox is on his way to Crawford this weekend. And at the beginning of the first term, there was a relationship between the two men that seemed to be relatively warm. Then, because of events, Mexico went off the radar scope, at least in this part of the country. Do you think that the immigration issues are going to rise to the fore again?
Talking with the governors when they were in Washington 2 weeks ago, it's clear that at least in parts of the country, the immigration issue has flamed again. The governor of Arizona, Janet Napolitano, was telling me that she and John McCain made joint TV ads in opposition to an initiative that was on the ballot there to basically cut off state aid to children of illegal immigrants. And she said, we just got killed. That people are just, that it's an angry, irrational reaction. They just don't, they're angry that they are being asked to pay for people who are in the country illegally. And to the extent that kind of thing, that immigration now is not just a border phenomenon, but has, I mean, there are very large populations of recent migrants in the border states, in obviously in most of the urban states and so on. I think this is an issue. Bush, to his credit, has tried to diffuse the anger. And I think he's found it difficult on the Republican side to keep it under control. And I think it's likely to be a difficult issue nationally to keep under control.
Sir?
I'm wondering how you think Karen Hughes now fits into the grand scheme of things, and in particular in the job that she's going into.
Well, Karen is a very able person. I do not underestimate Karen's abilities at all. She is, when she's around, the president does better. And she is herself a very good advocate. She starts, as far as I know, from ground zero in terms of her own background in the new assignment, and particularly if the focus is going to be on the Muslim world and the Middle East. But she's not dumb. And the fact that she has taken this assignment clearly implies, I mean, it's in a way, it's a counterpart to Condoleezza Rice being the Secretary of State. It means that Bush himself is committed now in this area. He doesn't want her to fail. And he understands that she's an important asset in the administration. And the fact that he's given her this job means that this job is important to him, which is not a bad position from which to begin. I certainly cannot begin to gauge the difficulty of the task. I don't know that part of the world myself, but it's clearly going to be a tough job. And all I can say is, I didn't know Charlotte Beers at all. I know Margaret Tutwiler for a long time, and Margaret, who is no sissy, just threw up her hands and said, "This is more than I can deal with." And Margaret can be plenty tough. So I got to believe this is going to be a very challenging assignment.
This being the Festival of the Book, we will have a book signing that will be in the area we call the lower hyphen. It's the lower downstairs entrance. So in order not to inconvenience Mr. Broder or any guests who wish to have books signed, after we show our appreciation to Mr. Broder, I'd like to ask everybody to stay in place so he can exit and go down to the book signing area and sign books for those who would like to do so. We have a limited number of books provided by the University of Virginia Bookstore for sale, so unfortunately we don't have an unlimited supply, but there's certainly some for those who would like to purchase one of his books. David Broder, we're extremely grateful for the insights you've given us and for your coming to Charlottesville today.
Thank you.